Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and 4 generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Can you feel it, as my man T.R. Shock likes to say? Ladies and gentlemen, it is another action-packed episode. 93 years, 4 generations, your Tennessee Stud is here to serve you. Today, Sputnik is in orbit. Dad's at the steakhouse, and a family feud is on the horizon. We take you back to Memphis. We're in the early to mid-60s. Put your hands together. Meet and greet your Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, 6'9", 265, Dyersburg, Tennessee. Stud, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tony. Great pleasure to be here today. Saddled up and ready to ride, man.
Can you feel it, my friend?
Absolutely. I feel it every time I sit down in this chair and we get ready to do this. I feel it. I'm filled with memories. I'm ready to spew them out. Let's unlock the vault. Let's just keep rolling her out. Let's move from one step in history on to the next step. And today's episode, I think people are going to find to be pretty mesmerizing. If you're a historian about wrestling, especially about one of the best wrestling cities in the history of the sport, Memphis, this one's for you, I'd say.
What's magical about getting a chance to sit with you, as somebody that's loved wrestling all my life, and I grew up in the Northeast, so a lot of these venues, some of these places, I've never really taken the time to look into them. You talked about Ellis Auditorium and the way that thing is laid out. And on the webpage, we link to Scotty Monroe's page where he had an article about Ellis Auditorium on there, and talk about, in the last episode, Elvis Presley. And then we learned about Crump Stadium. We've learned about some venues down in Atlanta in previous episodes here on the Studcast. I just love the history, the way we talk about some of the Southern history as we go along. We've already introduced parts of the civil rights struggle, which was going on as a part of Sputnik Monroe's story. There's just so much richness that when we start talking about and unlocking the story of your family and these other things that paralleled what was going on at the time, it's just, it's incredible, Stud, to look back at what your family went through.
Well, we're pretty unique. We cover such a long time span from Roy back in 1924, and we're progressing through decades, the Depression, the development of the sport as we go along, the history of it, the territories and how they were put together. It's an amazing little ride here. It's like we spur them up. Sometimes we get up to a fast gallop. Sometimes we want to walk along a little bit and rest that horse and then take a closer look at things. It's really an experience here. I'm loving every minute of it. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to empty out my head and to lay this stuff out there after all these years, never been told. It's an untold story of the most, some people say, wrestling's first family now, because we're older and bigger and more participants and more generations. We just go back further than anybody else. And thank goodness I got a pretty darn good memory. I have a lot of stuff locked in that vault up there in my head. And today we're going to pour out some more Memphis. we're going to, hopefully, sometimes we go slower than I anticipate we will, because we're trying to be so, I'm trying to be so thorough here. I'm trying not to forget some things that I'm going to look back and go, gosh, I wish I'd have said something about that or something about that. So we're going to today to try to get through Memphis, through the end of my dad's era in Memphis. And not the end of Memphis, because Memphis remains a phenomenal wrestling city for many, many years past the time that I leave there as a 12, 13-year-old boy. It keeps doing its thing. Let's just get right into it whenever you're ready. If you're ready, Tony, let's roll on it.
Well, it's great, because one of the names that keeps coming up is that of Sputnik Monroe. And I know that's where you wanted to start today. You've got a tale that you'd like to share regarding Sputnik Monroe and get this into the record. So go for it, stud.
All right. I think it's a great place for us to start today. Sputnik Monroe is the figure in 59, 60, 61 in Memphis. He becomes, as you said just a minute ago, he's in orbit. He is taken off. His career has just, it's exploded. He becomes the best he's ever going to be. He's becoming the biggest star he will ever be in the history of his time in wrestling. And Memphis is Sputnik, and Sputnik is Memphis. They just suck him up. They love Sputnik Monroe. And through all of the great things about Sputnik, Sputnik was a difficult person for Dad to deal with, because Sputnik liked to party. Sputnik was a player. He liked that Bourbon Street atmosphere. He liked to have himself a little drink when he got through wrestling. He wanted to enjoy himself. And every once in a while, he took it to extremes. So we're in an era here where Sputnik is just killing. The business is just tremendous. And Sputnik has himself a little Sunday afternoon stroll. The fair comes to town in Memphis. This is probably 1960. And the fair in Memphis, as in most cities, is a major event. It's a two-week event. In Memphis, it's a fair, and the big play where everybody strolls and plays the games and all the rides and all that. But it's also a stock show where people bring their cows, and most fairs are like this, and there's an actual rodeo that goes along with Memphis's fair. So Sputnik goes down there one Sunday afternoon. Wrestling is big there. Everybody knows him. Everybody's watching what's going on. And Sputnik, he was champion for a long, long time. He had a habit of wanting to wear his belt, not just to the ring, but everywhere he went. When he would go to Beale Street, he would put his belt on outside his clothes and walk down Bourbon and into the bars. And so he goes to the rodeo one Sunday. I think it's on a Saturday, to be quite honest with you, because it makes the Sunday's papers. But he goes to the rodeo on Saturday, and he goes in the back of the rodeo, and he's back there half drunk, shouldn't be there, mouthing off like Sputnik always does, and he's wanting to have some type of altercation. I don't know what's in his head, but he somehow gets hooked up with one of the cowboys. And the cowboy's standing there. He's got his horse, and his wife is standing there, and they're talking. And Sputnik walks up. He's got his championship belt on outside his pants, and he starts making comments about the rodeo guy. And he says, he's insulting him. He says something like, and I don't know the exact words, but I get this story from Dad, who hears the story from Sputnik himself, says, here's what happened. And he says, I told him, I said, boy, you're a kind of a runny guy, aren't you? He goes, you're pretty ugly, too. I mean, he just insults the guy. And the guy says, you know, he looks at him. He goes, I know who you are. He goes, you're a wrestler, and I see your championship belt there, and I'm not messing with you. And so Sputnik said, so he changes gears, and he goes, he looks at his wife, and he goes, is this your ugly wife? He goes, I believe she's uglier than you are. I mean, she's big and fat, and he starts insulting the guy's wife, the cowboy's wife. And the cowboy goes, now look, he goes, you know, it's okay. You know, I know who you are, you know, and I don't want to have no trouble. I'd like for you not to say some bad things about my wife. He's being very, very nice. So Sputnik sees he's not going to get anywhere. So he reaches up. The guy's standing there with his horse, and he grabs his horse by the reins. Horse is standing there very calmly, and he jerks real hard on his reins, and he says, "Is this your stupid-looking horse?" And that was the thing that rolled it into the where it proceeded. That was more than the old cowboy could take. He didn't care. You can insult me. You can insult my wife, but don't touch my horse. And he knocked Sputnik cold. Hits him in the side of the head. Down he goes. Everybody sees it. Big crowd develops. Somebody takes a picture. Next day in the paper, I remember my dad getting up. They deliver the Sunday paper. And I hear him in the other room, and he goes, "Oh, my gosh." And there's a picture on the front page of Sputnik laying on his back, his championship belt around his waist, and he's out cold. And the cowboy has knocked out the champion. All over the front page of the paper. So my dad's in, like, damage control here. What in the heck am I going to do with this? So he calls Sputnik. Sputnik tells the story, and he goes, "What in the heck is wrong with you?" They have an argument, I'm sure. And finally, Dad says, "I want you to find this cowboy. I want to send someone from the paper." So Dad starts damage control. He finds someone at the paper that will follow Sputnik. They've tracked down the cowboy, and Sputnik challenges the cowboy. And the cowboy is a pretty smart guy. Then they write about this the next day in the paper, and he says, Sputnik challenged the guy, and the cowboy says, "You know," he goes, "that makes sense." He goes, "I can't imagine why that guy went down so easy." He goes, "There ain't no way I could knock that wrestler out that easily." He goes, "I know y'all just set me up. Sputnik's challenged him for a match." He goes, "I know y'all just set me up." He goes, "I'd be an idiot to wrestle this guy, to get in the ring with this guy, because he's going to kill me." So that's the way they end up writing the story. It was a big black eye for Sputnik, who had been there and a big star for a long time. They pretty well covered it up, and they pretty well explained that, didn't truly, if Sputnik hadn't been drinking, the guy wouldn't have been able to do that to him. But it's just to show you how guys can benefit you to such an extreme, and at the same time, when it concerns wrestling, to hurt you so badly with something as stupid as what Sputnik did. A big mistake by Sputnik, but it gives you an idea that he wasn't all just a fabulous figure that did wonderful things. He's like anybody else. He's pretty much human.
I dug a story up, Stud, while you were talking about that, and this is from the Williamson Herald. You can find this on the Stud's page, as we'll have a link to it. This is the obituary of a man by the name of Ray the Kid Marley, and this runs in the newspaper. Once Ray the Kid Marley passes away, and he is that cowboy that you're talking about, who on April 7th, 76, passed away at the age of 76 in Parsons, Tennessee, from injuries sustained months earlier while training a horse. So there's a man out there at the age of 76 still training a horse. Listen to what his son recounts about what happened with his father. "One year at a rodeo in Memphis during my father's prime, mind ya, pro wrestler named Sputnik Monroe showed up one night to challenge any cowboy to a fight. It was supposed to be a publicity stunt. Thing is, nobody told my father that. Boy, did he pick on the wrong guy. Well, to make a long story short, by the time the media got a hold of it and Sputnik got out of the hospital, my father was offered a wrestling contract and he just laughed it off." It's pretty accurate, isn't it?
I'll tell you what, man. You know, and you find this stuff, you could really make me look bad, Tony, if you wanted to. And I'm telling that, I haven't told that story in 40 years, maybe. And it's pretty darn accurate as to what went on. He didn't go there just to find one guy. He went there to pick himself a fight with a rodeo guy. And he found himself the wrong guy. It's pretty amazing. And then they offered him the contract, and the guy's smart enough to know, well, hell, if I go in the ring with this guy, he's going to hurt me. So it's crazy, crazy business. It was a crazy time. That was a crazy guy. Sputnik was an absolutely crazy guy. I'm going to go one other little story on Sputnik, and it ain't so much Sputnik. We've talked about it. Go ahead.
If I can say one thing before you go there, it points to this, and you've talked about this before. And, you know, I do football, covered University of Tennessee, but SEC football, college football. The coaches on the football team back in the day, okay, I've had guys tell me this, played back in the 70s and 80s. I know of this happening. They go to a fight in a fraternity house, and they start a fight. I'll give you a story. This dovetails exactly what your dad had to deal with here. This one kid had to go get several teammates to help him in a fight in a fraternity house. When a coach found out about it, he made this kid run around until he threw up. He said, I don't want guys on my football team that can't take care of regular students. Your dad, once this happened, Sputnik Monroe had to go down the card. It's like those promoters used to say to guys, you go into a bar and you start a fight, you better win that fight. Or if a guy starts a fight with you, you better win that fight because we have a business here to protect. And it stands to reason what happened with Sputnik Monroe only served to damage the business. If you can't elaborate on how important it was, if you go in there and you pick a fight, you better win that fight.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're arrested. People watch you on TV and they say, well, geez, this is one of the toughest guys in the world. And in a lot of cases, that was absolutely the truth. Sputnik wasn't a great shooter, and Sputnik drank, and that was his problem. He goes on a Saturday night, and it turns out to be a Saturday night. That's pretty strange, but he's drinking, he's having a good time, and he wants to go down and get some publicity of some kind, I assume. I don't know what's in his head. Neither did my dad, I'm sure. And it can be damaging to your business. And, you know, the only thing Sputnik could do is go and challenge this guy. This guy would have, Sputnik would have hurt him. Sputnik would have, he wasn't drinking, and he would have showed up to that match. He wouldn't have been drinking, and it would have been a different outcome. But it just really shows you, and I agree with what you're talking about with football players. It's kind of like back to the story, I think I may have told this, about Dory Sr. having to fight in the dressing room with two guys who was on his card, and they were tag team partners. He beat the hell out of one of them, and the second one, after he finished with the first one, the second one beat the hell out of Dory Sr. Dory Sr. got up, he's all bloody, and he looked over at the guy that he had beat up, and he says, you're finished here. You ain't tough enough. And to the one that beat the heck out of him, he points to him, and he says, you're my champion. You are a bad son of a gun. I want you here, right? So it's just, that's that mindset. That's those old football coaches. They don't want you. If you can't beat up a frat boy, you know, you ain't going to make it on the football team. It's just not going to happen, you know. That's a very understandable story. And if you can't be a wrestling champion and go down to the rodeo and get your butt knocked out and everybody say, well, he's a big, tough son of a gun. Now, I built Sputnik for two or three programs, and now I kind of take him down here, put him on a lower level. But in the end, Sputnik Monroe is one of the greatest guys. I'm going to tell you a quick story. I wrestled Sputnik Monroe. It's a two-ring battle royal in Memphis. First one I was ever in my life. And what they do is they take two rings and push them side by side. When you've got an apron, and there's an apron about 12 inches wide that you can stand on out there for tag matches or whatever. So you take those two aprons and you put them together, and you've got ropes now that are about 3 feet apart, those two rings. And we're going to the ring, and Sputnik says, backdrop me from one ring into the other. And I think about it, and I go, wait a minute. And I said, you want me to backdrop you from ring one over two sets of ropes and into ring two? And he goes, yes. And I said, you're going to get killed. And he goes, no, no, do this. So we go out there, and at some point in the match, when you've got 20 guys in two rings, you can't just throw somebody in and backdrop them. The people in the other ring aren't watching. You're going to land on top of somebody. Somebody's going to get hurt. So I stay in there, and me and him are in one of those rings until there's only about three guys in the other ring, and there's maybe three or four in the ring that I'm in. And I snatch him up, and I shoot him in the fire ropes, and I'm going to backdrop him like he wanted from one ring into the next. Well, if Sputnik had a way of hitting you when you backdropped, he liked to go real high, so he would hit you in an upright manner. He would drive you back. It would lose your balance. I'd never backdropped him before, so I stepped back a step when he hit me. I lost my balance a little bit, and when I shot him up, he didn't get the height that he wanted to. He went up into the air. He went into the second ring, but he went head first, and he went between the second and the top rope and just smashed his skull right into the mat, bang, on his head. I thought it killed him. I watched it happen like the other guys who were in the ring. They were like, what in the hell is that all about? And so I go, wow, I got to do something. So I got out of the ring. I go into the second ring and I get him up. I figure he's unconscious. He comes up, he's staggering to his feet, and he says, let's do it again. So I just whip him across the ring, and this time I catch him good, and I backdrop his butt over two sets of ropes. One of the best bumps I ever saw, probably one of the best bumps that anybody ever saw in Memphis. So that was Sputnik. He was a determined individual, talented, but unreliable in some respects. Great talent. One more, I'll finish up with, we talked last program about that Cadillac match and I'm carrying the Cadillac with the Billy Wicks in it out of the stadium. And after that match that night, we went to dinner with my dad. Now, my dad, he's got Roy in his blood, but he's a little different than Roy. But in some ways, he was the same. And I tell this story for that reason. It gives an opportunity for people to see what we're all about. It's me and Rob. I'm 12. He's 11. My mom and dad. It's in a real nice steakhouse. I believe the name of it was Jim's Steakhouse in Memphis. And we go in. Everybody is dressed in suits and nice clothes. Dad's dressed pretty nicely. We've got on nice clothes. We've just come from the biggest wrestling event in the history of Memphis. And we're going to celebrate in this restaurant. We sit down in the restaurant. And across from us at a table is two guys. And my mom's a very pretty lady at that point. She's young. She's got dark black hair. She's very attractive. And one of the guys sitting at the table starts flirting with her. And she's not flirting with him, but he's trying to get her attention. And somehow Dad notices it. And I'm a young boy. I didn't really grasp it. I didn't see that part of it going on. Later on, he explained to me why he does what he does. But he puts up with this, I assume, for a little while, maybe 10 minutes or whatever. We've been served, and the other two guys have been served. And it's a steakhouse, so we've got steak. And we're eating our steak, and all of a sudden, Dad gets up, and he goes over to the guy sitting at the table that's flirting with my mom, trying to flirt with my mom, and he picks him up by the lapels of his suit, jerks him up in the air, spins him around, and slams him sitting in his steak. Just slams him on the table. Drinks go flying off the table. His friend slides away from the table. Now the guy's sitting on his steak at the table. And Dad does the old Roy deal. He grabs him by the throat like Roy used to do people back in the 30s and the 40s when he was building his territory. And he gets up real close to him. And he whispers something in the guy's ear. And Rob and I, we're astounded. We don't see Dad do this type of thing very often. I don't know why it upset him so much, but it got to him so much that I guess he felt like he had to do something. So he slams him in his steak. He whispers in his ear, chokes him a little bit in the process, and comes back and sits down very quietly. And we continue to eat like nothing's happened. Now, the guy is still sitting over there in his steak. He does not get up and sit back down. His friend kind of backs off from the table, and they kind of whisper at each other. And at that point, I'm like really intrigued by what's going on. Guy just sits there. We probably eat for another 10 minutes. The guy does not get out of his steak because people know who Dad is. And he's a personality in Memphis. The owner of the steakhouse is a buddy. He doesn't go and take Dad and throw him out or any of that. He just basically puts up with it. He lets it go down like it's going down. Everybody quiets down in the restaurant. We finish our meal. Dad pays the bill. We walk out. And I look back, and the guy's still sitting in his steak at the table. And I go to the car and I say, Dad, what did you say to him? He said, I told him that if you get out of your steak before I leave this restaurant, I'm going to come back over here and you're not going to like what happens to you next. So to me, it was like, wow, you know, this is a pretty much a, I had a lot of respect for my dad. I thought that was the way he handled it was good in some respects, and others, most people would have said, oh, gosh, that's a horrible way to do somebody. But it really showed that guy got instant respect for my dad, especially when he run that thumb in his throat and he give him the old Roy treatment. Then the guy, he would have done anything he asked him to do. I wanted to leave it with that one because it's a different type of story. Roy, we got a lot of that kind of stuff with Dad. It wasn't very often, but when he made a move, it was usually very determined. It usually got the results he wanted.
Yeah, and that's two great examples there. One guy saying to the business or making the business look like something that you could mess with, and another guy publicly trying somebody who faces the consequence. And you saw different ranges with your father. Story you're going to get into here is the family feud. You know, you saw your dad as a hero up on top, and then unfortunately you got to see your dad in the middle of a family feud. I'd like you to introduce that if you can, as we are about just looking at it, we're about 27 or so minutes into our extravaganza today, Stud, but go ahead and introduce that if you can.
Okay. It's pretty interesting. Memphis has lots of different owners over a period of time from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. Dad's just one of those that passes through there. He happens to be the most successful one to ever pass through there. But prior to Dad, there's Les Wolf. And prior to Les Wolf, I don't know who has Memphis. But for some reason, Roy never gets control of Tennessee's largest city. He has yet to gain control of Memphis. Roy has created all these athletic commissions. We've talked about this to perpetuate his monopoly. It helped him to control the 12 states in which he was doing business. He had a Tennessee boxing and wrestling commission. And Dad was going great guns. Just everything is on fire. And all of a sudden, the athletic commission starts to mess with Dad. They come and tell him, which is unheard of. They say something like, as an example, and I don't know what the issues were because I'm a 12-year-old kid, but I talked to people later on and they kind of explain some of this stuff. They come to him as an example and say, you can't have wrestlers throw anybody out onto the floor anymore. And Dad goes, now, wait a minute. You know, I mean, this is a wrestling match. And everywhere else in the country, you know, they throw people out on the floor. Well, you can't have people do that anymore. And you can't have a guy do this or do that like you've done in the past. And he's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Well, if you do, they start saying to him, if you do, then we're going to fine you. And it could get worse. So all of a sudden, he's gone 2 years here with no problem from anyone, especially not the athletic commission. And all of a sudden, this athletic commission, especially the commissioners in Memphis, have a problem with just about everything he's doing. So he gets very perturbed by it. He gets extremely upset. He's no longer in control of his own town. He doesn't know how to handle it. He gets very disinterested in doing business anymore. It frustrates him because he says to them, you don't have the right to tell me how to run my business. And they say, yes, we do, because we're the athletic commission. So he says, well, what about Nashville, where Roy is, and Chattanooga or Knoxville, where Kazana is, and different promoters? He says, do they not have their wrestlers throwing people out on the floor? Are you stopping them from doing the same thing? And he got no answer. So he figures that something's going on here. It turns out that as time goes on here, over a period of months, this fight between him and the Tennessee Athletic Commission escalates to the point to where they say, you are going to have to leave Memphis, that you're not going to be able to run wrestling in Memphis anymore. They take away his town, in essence, and it just so happens that, so Dad's a stubborn guy, and he's already, now, they don't realize that for Dad, he's accomplished the same thing he accomplished in Mobile. When he left Mobile, he had drawn those big, huge crowds. He had taken a territory from drawing nothing to being spectacularly successful, and he lost his incentive to stay. He had seen the great sellouts. He had done everything he wanted to accomplish, and he's at that point in Memphis. He's already done everything he could have possibly done. He's set records that no one will ever break, and he's really ready to go. So this little thing with the athletic commission, he could have stayed there living in that nice home on that beautiful farm, and he says, I'm not going to put up with any of this anymore. You can have the town. So he basically walks away from one of the best wrestling cities in America, his own little territory that's just on fire and doing tremendous business. And we move out of that 10,000, 12,000 square foot house, I don't know how big it was, into a house trailer in Mobile, Alabama. We go from top of the world to bottom of the bucket. And it's really, really, it's shocking. To my mom, she leaves a house full of furniture. He doesn't even move the furniture. He just sells the house, the farm, the furniture. I'm gone. I'm out. And within 2 months from the time it starts falling and tanking in this problem, we're gone and we're living in Mobile again in a house trailer. It's kind of like the story of our lives as young guys. You know, we've moved from Mobile to Memphis, and now all of a sudden we've moved back to Mobile, and we're about to move beyond that to becoming farmers, to a different lifestyle entirely. And I think it's important for people to see that when you're in the wrestling business, as a son of a wrestler, you never know where you're going to live or where you're going to be. And when you're a promoter, you probably have more stability than if you're a wrestler. If you're a wrestler and they don't like you where you are and they say, here's your 2-week notice, you've got to not only leave there, but you've got to find some place to go and make a living again. And you change from one territory to another territory to another territory to another territory. Over the period of my life, I counted it up one time. I went to 12 high schools, just high schools alone, 12 high schools in 6 different states. Just move, 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 move. And that's hard for a kid. And I used to think it was a deterrent for me to have friends or whatever it was. But I really figured out in the long run, it was probably the best thing for me. I got to see so many different cities and live in so many different parts of the country, see life lived by different people in different places. I learned more maybe than I would ever learn from going to one particular school by going to 10 or 15, probably 20 schools in my lifetime I went to as a young kid from first grade through 12th grade. Travel broadens the mind. The old saying was, Dad used to always say, I would say, Dad, why we got to move again? He would say, travel broadens your mind, boy. And really, it probably did. It made me kind of what I am. Same thing for Rob. We went through some tough times. It was a different type of life. All of a sudden, we're in Memphis, and bang, and 2 months later, we're living in Mobile, and our lives are totally different. It's just overnight change.
Any ideas, you look back, what led to that? That whole thing, Roy moving on Buddy Fuller the way he did?
I think Roy always wanted Memphis. And Roy is the type of guy who gets what he wants. And somehow Memphis got away from him. He was able to develop his 12-state territory. He didn't have any cities that he didn't own himself unless he had the guys living there that he wanted to do business with. And they're going to pay him the 10% booking, and he's going to provide them talent. He basically owns it without owning it. They think they own it, but he's in control of it. And Memphis, he had no control. Now, his son, my dad and my granddad had a different relationship than I had with my dad. Roy never wanted my dad to wrestle. That's strange to me. Dad always wanted me and Rob to be wrestlers. He pushed us. He trained us. He had a ring available to us whenever we wanted it. It was his goal, I believe, in life. And Roy was just the opposite. He had 3 brothers that were wrestling, and he thought that there's too many Welches already, and you're not going to end up in this business. He discouraged him. Dad started working out, and Roy would come by and get him out of the ring. Come here. He called him Bunyan. He said, come here, Bunyan. and he would take him off and say, you're not cut out for this, boy. You don't want to be in this. You don't need to be in this. So when Dad got into it and he became successful as a wrestler and even more successful as a promoter, and then he comes back to Memphis right in the heart of Roy's territory, and he owns the best city in America. He owns the biggest city in Roy's whole 12-state territory. Memphis is drawing more money than anybody. And Roy, I believe, says, I can't take it. I got to pull the strings here with my athletic commission people like I have for 30 years now. And I want the kid out. I want Memphis. I want to own that town. And that's how that changed hands. That's what it all broke down to, father wanting to ditch his own son so that he could have that town. And that's what happened with Memphis.
People listen to that, it's got to sound very harsh. I mean, the grandfather has everything. The father has everything. Why would you want the son to succeed? I mean, that's sad.
I don't understand their relationship. I really, and I've tried all my life to figure it out. And Dad used to tell me, I don't think Roy really loved me. And I know he didn't want me to be a wrestler. Actually, the other day, Rob and I were talking. He had heard a little with one of those stud casts in which I said how Dad got his name. And he substituted for a guy named Buddy Fuller. And Rob said, did you not know that Roy told him, I don't want you to ever wrestle as a Welch? And I did not know that. Nobody had ever told me that before. Rob says, you didn't know that Roy told Dad that I don't want you to wrestle as a Welch. You can't be Edward Welch. You find another name if you want to wrestle. And that's what made Dad go to find it. Finally got the name of Buddy Fuller. That, to me, I'm learning about my family all the time. Rob and I talk sometimes, and Rob tells me things that I didn't know. And he popped this one on me the other day, and I'm like, are you kidding? I didn't know that. He goes, absolutely. He said, Dad told me that. He said, Roy told me you can't wrestle as a Welch. You got to find another name. So that was a relationship the two of them had.
It's remarkable stuff here, and you hear the honesty in Ron Fuller's voice, the Tennessee Stud, as he talks about recounting the family feud between his grandfather and his father, and you can just hear the honesty there. We come back, we're going to deal and visit with you. When we come back, we are going to do something that the Stud loves, I love, we love, which is interacting with you. I want to encourage you, if you have a question or a comment on today's program, join the Stud's Facebook page, Ron Fuller Welch on Facebook. Also, visit tnstud.com. On that note, a brief timeout, and then we come back on the other side and we pick it up more with the Stud on another action-packed episode here on your Studcast.
This is Studcast number 13, featuring stud stories as told by the legendary Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, and hosted by Tony Basilio. This Studcast will continue in a moment. Attention, Studcast fans. We're proud to announce the release of a specially designed Studcast t-shirt, now available at the Stud Store at tnstud.com. Show your style and support with this first ever extraordinary Tennessee Stud t-shirt. It has logos on the front and back. It comes in all sizes, including double and triple XL, and that includes shipping and handling. Take a look now and be the first to wear this beautiful t-shirt. Also, coming in the next 3 weeks is the most requested item by our fans. Thousands have asked how they can own Studcast and play them whenever they wish on a platform other than the internet, especially for older fans that don't have internet access. We will offer on the Stud Store a limited edition collector CD imprinted with the Stud logo. This complete series of CDs will each contain 5 episodes of Studcast with a special introduction and closing thank you by the Tennessee Stud himself. The first should be available soon and will feature Studcast number 1 through 5, and every 5 weeks a new CD will be available to add to your collection so that every fan can own a piece of the Tennessee Stud forever. It makes a great gift for older fans, family members, or anyone that is a collector or just wants to relive the stories. So, Stud fans, at the conclusion of today's episode, go to the website at tnstud.com. tnstud.com. Click on the Stud Store, get your t-shirt, and thanks for riding with the Tennessee Stud. You are back, seated ringside, on this edition of the Ron Fuller Studcast.
And we welcome you back. as I was saying when we left, Stud, now it's time for us to interface with an audience that is growing, an audience that is verbal, an audience that is spreading the word for you, an audience who 3 months in, we're about 3 months in now, has taken ownership of what's going on here with the Studcast. And that has to be a great feeling for you, the online community that you're building. And we want to thank the great Brian Last for helping with the push, as we say in the business. It's just been a great thing, man. What a blessing to be a part of this.
It's phenomenal. Yeah, I keep using the old word humble, but it's the best word. I mean, I can't believe it. It's overwhelming. The numbers are astronomical. We are fast becoming a world phenomenon. It's not just United States. We are having a presence in England and Sweden and Australia. We got Japan, Japanese people. I don't know how they understand what we say, but there are some people in Japan, obviously, that are speaking English. We have fans. We have letters and comments from Ireland and Micronesia. We had a person that won one of our contests here, our question contest, from Ponape, Micronesia, someplace. I mean, it's amazing where we are going with this and how many people are just loving it. Comments are astronomical. They're just, we keep putting them on the website. If you want to go there and see what people have to say about us, we put it on there just simply because I like to look at it myself. I get blown away by it. I'm like, this guy says it. I had a guy the other day that says, it's part of my week. It's part of my life. I live for Studcast Day when I can turn on that new episode and get another one. It's phenomenal, Tony. I'm proud of it. I'm proud to be a part of it. We are lucky that we have such a wrestling world out there that still wants to know what the old times were like and how it all happened and how it got to be where it is today. And we're on that journey. We're taking that ride a little bit every week. And we're chronologically, I think, doing pretty good at staying with it. But this segment here is wonderful, because it's going to take us in a different direction. And I think that's fans get, you know, they want to hear, well, let's talk about some of the things you did. And some, we're going to get to a lot of the things we did. We're working our way right now toward me and Jimmy's generation and what we've done and where we went. So this segment is a wonderful one. I really love it. I say let's get to rolling on it. Let's get these people in the saddle and see where they want to ride.
Tom Doss of Pall Mall, Tennessee, not to be confused with Salem, Virginia, or Salem Lights, Virginia, asked the following. And by the way, this could be 3 episodes, and no doubt we will unpack this with great detail down the line here on the Studcast. Tom Doss asks, after the Knoxville and All-Star split in 1979, there was major heat between you, Garvin, Orton, and Roop, to name a few. Fast forward 35 plus years later, would you speak to any of these wrestlers now due to the resentment back in those days? Do you have a relationship, Stud, with those guys?
Great question. One of the most difficult moments in my life, because I ran a company that for many years was extremely successful with one of the greatest crews. Some of the greatest young wrestlers in the world wrestled for me in Knoxville, and we were close friends. We played on the lakes together. We all had boats. Everyone that worked in Knoxville during that years from 74 to 79. If you were in Knoxville, the story was you're working in the best territory in the world. And I got all these guys that wanted to come because everybody was happy. And something happened. We're going to save this because this, like you say, we could do 3 shows on this. We're going to save a big portion of this. I'm just going to get straight to his question. And his question basically was, am I friends with any of those guys, Garvin, Orton, Roop, as an example? To this day, have we made up, so to speak? It was hard for me. When this all went down, I had a southern end. I had a business that had already gotten taken off in Pensacola. It was also called Southeastern Wrestling. I expected to have 2 businesses, a northern and a southern territory. And the northern territory, I had a problem. Those guys were in the northern territory. Had things not gone like they went, they would have been a part of that southern territory. They'd have been a part of that wonderful run in Pensacola that we're not even talking about yet. yet, bigger than Knoxville, a bigger run. Things going to get better and bigger, not smaller. But anyway, we have a problem, and they run against me. They mutiny the ship. Let's put it that way. They're a part of the mothership that they've come to and been a part of and been happy to be there, been paid well, taken care of. But they decide they want to own a piece of it, and they're going to take it. They're going to take my company from me. Bad deal, bad thing. And it turned out to be, it killed Knoxville for wrestling for a while there. And from 1979 to 1985, no one could go there and draw money. Georgia Championship Wrestling couldn't draw money. Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan couldn't go there from Carolina and draw money. Nobody could replace what we had accomplished in those 5 years there. No one could follow us. No one could follow us is what it basically amounted to. I go to wrestling reunions in Mobile, Alabama. I've been twice in the past 3 years. 3 years ago, I went to the wrestling reunion in Mobile, Alabama. I had not talked to Ronnie Garvin, Bob Orton, or Bob Roop, none of those guys since the day that they mutinied, that they decided they were going to run their own company against me. And I go there, and there's Ronnie Garvin and Bob Orton at this reunion. And I'm kind of surprised. I didn't expect to see them there. And I didn't, for a while, I was a little uncomfortable with how to handle it. And I go to church a lot, oddly enough. Maybe some people they might think it's odd, but I've learned some Christian values, and one of them is forgiveness. And I sat there and thought about it. I see them. I don't speak to them, but they're there. I say to myself, it's time to forgive. Now, this is 30 years later. And I go over and sit down and start talking to Ronnie. Ronnie Garvin and I go back further than Knoxville. We were young guys in Florida, 1970, 71, 72, 73. We wrestled each other a lot. We grew up wrestling and learning how to work against each other. We graduated from Fort Myers on Tuesday night to Tampa on Tuesday night. We became stars in Florida. And when I went to Knoxville, he was one of the first guys I wanted to bring because he was such a hard worker in the ring. But we had not spoken in 30 years. And I went and sat down at his table with him. And I said, Ronnie, I think it's time we buried the hatchet. I'll forgive you for what happened. I hope if you're mad at me or you don't respect me or however you feel about me, that you can do the same. We had a wonderful conversation. I did the same thing with Bob Orton Jr. I made a point to go sit down at his table. And when we left that convention, I hugged those two guys. We had made up entirely. And I see them now. 2 years later, I go to that same reunion and I see them again. And we're kind of back to where we were in 1979 through that horrible experience. And it turned out to be a bad experience for them because they lost the deal. I mean, I was able to sell my business and move on, but they lost their spots with a great company and with a great guy that was making them money, and the opportunity to go to Pensacola and live on the beach and have a better time than they had in Knoxville, all that was gone for them. So, you know, we all sacrificed through that whole experience. It was tough. It was tough. But yes, answer to the question is, I've made up with them. I've hugged them both. I care for both of them. I forgive them, and I hopefully they forgive me, and I think they really do, and it's a great question.
Yeah, it's an awesome question, and again, that's going to be a future episode of the Studcast that'll no doubt be one, two, or three-parter inside the genesis of what went on there. That's a story I know you've touched on in other venues, but one where we really haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty of what went on, and it's fascinating to hear you talk about just the healing of going through that, because I'm like you, I'm a Christ believer myself, and I just know that healing is real. And I also know that anybody listening to us, whether they're a believer or not in God, knows what it's like to have heat with somebody, walk in a room with somebody you have heat with, feeling that pit in your stomach, feeling that fight or flight feeling that you have where do I go confront this person? Do I just ignore them and it's the elephant in the room? And we've all been there. We've all handled that in different ways. What a terrific storyteller you are. Another question comes from, and thanks for bringing the truth there on that and sharing with us the inside of your machinations there. And again, we'll go back to that down the line here on the Studcast. Question number two today comes from a personal friend of mine who I've seen many a wrestling event with and been to many a card with and who's loves you. Stud, I will just tell you, this man loves you. Not that I'm going to color who gets the prize today, but this man today in question two loves you and spreads the word for you, Stud. Not that I'm going to color who gets the prize here, but Dwayne Light out of Knoxville asked the following. How close were you to getting the NWA belt? Did the powers that be ever consider putting the strap on you? Stud, take it away.
Great question. We all want that belt. When I'm a kid and I'm watching in the ring and I see Buddy Rogers wear it, I see Lou Thesz wear it, I see Pat O'Connor wear it, I dream that someday I'm going to be that world champion myself. And I was headed there, Tony. And yes, I think, you know, they don't come and talk to you, I don't think, and tell you, hey, look, we're thinking about doing this. But you start to see it in what happens to you. In 1973 in Florida, I'd been wrestling for 3 years. I had had a great run as a young guy. Normally, it takes 6 or 8 years for a guy to figure it out and to become a star. And I had done it in 3 years. And part of that was because Florida was so embedded with great talent that it was making me great fast. I was working with really great workers. In 73, they started sending me to St. Louis. St. Louis was the home of Sam Muchnick, head of the National Wrestling Alliance for predominantly most of its existence from 48 on. And it was his city. If you got to wrestle in St. Louis one time, it signified to you that you were becoming some type of a star. Well, in my case, it wasn't just one time. Sam Muchnick brought me in the first time I went to St. Louis. He called me and he said, I'm sending a taxi. I want to bring you to my office downtown. And I spent an afternoon with Sam and we walked the walls of his office. Gosh, for a kid like me, it was absolutely unbelievable experience. Walls, pictures of Ed Strangler Lewis and Jim Londis and all these old timers all the way up. It was an afternoon of pure joy for me because my life had been built around it. And he basically says, without saying it, he let me know that, Ron, I don't just want you here for one show. I want you here for every show for the next 2 years. And I kind of put two and two together, you know, and there was scuttlebutt around. I had a couple of guys say, you know, Ron, I think they're going to put the strap on you. I think you're going to be the guy someday. And, you know, I never really put much credence in that. But that afternoon I spent with Sam in his office in St. Louis, when the way we talked and the way he talked to me, I really had a feeling that, you know, maybe there is something for me. What happened to me and kept me from getting there? I went there for 2 years. I drew Sam tremendous crowds. I got over in St. Louis very well. I wrestled Terry and Junior and Flair, and I wrestled all these guys. Some were already champions. Some were going to be champions. And I was winning. I was winning. I was winning. I was getting there. And then I decided I wanted to buy my own business. I decided I wanted to be a wrestler rather than, I mean, a promoter rather than just a wrestler. That decision, I think, put an end to my potential for being world champion, because to everybody that makes those decisions, it says to them, he wants to do his own thing and he's not willing to travel anymore. You can't be world champion if you don't want to get on that plane every day and fly to a different part of the world and a different part of the country. And I made that decision to run my own company, to run my own business. I think I gave up my opportunity to be a world champion. I don't regret it. I don't regret it. But at the same time, everybody that's in my shoes and was in my shoes wanted. That was the big prize. It was the belt you really wanted. You wanted to be that world champion, that NWA world champion. And that opportunity left me when I came to Knoxville and said, I want to be a promoter too.
And ironically enough, Dwayne Light out of Knoxville, great question there. Let's go to our next one. Justin Matthews, who is from Broken Hill, New South Wales in Australia. Was there any local talent you wrestled in Australia that you thought could have made it big in the U.S.? That's a great question, Stud.
Super question. My favorite country. If you're not talking the United States, it's the favorite place I have on earth. They are great people there. And it's a beautiful place to live. It's a beautiful place to work. It was a great place to work when I worked there in 73. I went there in 71 for 2 weeks. I went there in 73 for 3 months. I really became almost an Aussie myself. I love their accent. I love those people. They are great. And the answer to your question is yes, there were four. I have four come to my head very quickly that made that transition from Australia to American. One of them is George Barnes. I have a little story about George. I'll come back to him. The second one is Bill Dundee. Lives in Nashville, wrestled for Jarrett. He wrestled in the same city we talked about recently. It's a Memphis. He's a Memphis story. He's a Tennessee story. He's still there. He still lives in America. I don't know if he's ever been back to Australia. He's a wonderful guy, great guy, personal friend of mine. Johnny Gray, another kid, good wrestler, good athlete out of Australia. And the fourth one is Tony Gurria. Tony Gurria worked for Vince Sr., works for Vince Jr., may still be up there in Connecticut. I don't know for sure, but a very handsome guy, a good body, a good worker. I got one story real quick here. This is about George Barnes, and I love this story because it makes Australia, and I just love that country. George Barnes, in Australia in 73 and all the years preceding when Jim Barnett started cranked up wrestling in Australia back in the 60s, he brings wrestlers from all over the world, and the Aussie boys do the jobs. They're never on top. They've been there for years and years and years. And George Barnes is there. He's a great worker, tough kid, tough Aussie, man. He's a standard bearer for that country in my mind. And I remember him wrestling on TV in Sydney. They had a lot of televisions there. You wrestle live in Sydney. You wrestle live in Melbourne. You wrestle three times on television in Brisbane on Wednesdays alone. So there were five televisions that you could wrestle on. George Barnes and then the Aussies had never won a match. He wrestled a guy named Greg Peterson on TV in Sydney. I'm in the studio. I'm actually on that card. I've wrestled there earlier. And I see George Barnes go out to the ring, and him and Greg Peterson have a problem. And George Barnes, Greg gets really mad at him, and Greg hardways him. He hits him over the right eye and busts his eye, and they get into a brawl. It's a shoot. And the match has become a shoot. And George beats him. George pins Greg Peterson. Greg Peterson, a pretty tough little wrestler, been around for a long time. Then there's no interview scheduled for George Barnes. He's not supposed to go to the deal because he's probably not supposed to win, but he beats Greg Peterson. For the first time, an Aussie wins a match on television in Australia, and he goes and just interrupts the microphone. The commentator is a former rugby star named Michael Cleary. And he says, Michael, he goes, I want to have my say. And he does it in that beautiful Aussie accent. He says, by golly, he goes, never. And he's got the blood running down his face and it's dripping on his chest. And he goes, this Aussie will never lose to an American again. He goes, we've been beaten and beaten and beaten here for 10 years. And he goes, there's no one of us that's ever won. He goes, but by God, this Aussie will never, ever, ever be beat by an American again. I sat in that dressing room, watched that interview. I got goosebumps. I said, my God, something fabulous just happened in this country, because he never did lose again. And all of a sudden, crowds started to just, they always drew, but they started to draw more money than they'd ever drawn there. And all of a sudden, there comes Bill Dundee, and there comes this Johnny Gray, and there comes this Tony Garea, and he amasses his Aussie army, and we're going to take our country back. And by God, they did. It was inspiring to me.
Who were guys, and this is kind of the question was, he was asking about guys you thought could have made it big in the States that didn't make it. So let me ask as a follow-up to that. Who were guys that American wrestling fans never saw, that basically wrestled in that part of the world, who could have made it if they would have come over? Can you give me a couple names of guys whose paths you crossed, you thought, you know, this guy, if given the opportunity in the States, could knock it out, if given the chance? You have a couple names that come to mind, Stud?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we just covered four Aussies here. I'm going to tell you some others. In the 1973 crew that I was with, it was a worldwide crew. I'd never seen such a diverse wrestling group in my life. From Italy, you had a guy named Mario Milano that was a tremendous wrestler, fabulous wrestler, great body, good talker. He couldn't speak English very well, so when he did interviews, he did his interviews in Italian. He spoke directly to the Italian population in Australia. I loved it. I couldn't understand a thing he said, but I loved the fact that he was just dedicated to draw those Italian people. In that same crew from Greece was Spiros Arion. He was a phenomenal talent, a great-looking athlete, really, really built well, could get it done in the ring. And the same principle, he could barely speak English, so he spoke on his interviews in Greek. He actually spoke to the Greek people in Australia. There was one from India, a guy named Sabu Singh, who was, Indian wrestlers are, they're different. They're very tough. They wrestle a different style. Sabu Singh spoke a little bit of English, so he could make English interviews, but they would have him speak to the Indian people. I thought it was ingenious that Barnett would bring these people from different countries and have them speak in their language to the people out there, because Australia is it's like a melting pot, and they have these people, there's populations, a Greek population in the cities, and there's Italian population, and there's Indians from India, and he worked to all of them. And when you went to a match, you would hear people talking and you wouldn't know what language they were speaking in, because that match, it led to a combination of nations that were represented each night. It was an experience. I loved Australia for so many reasons, and someday, Tony, I have Australian stories that maybe the best in my head come from Australia. Really wonderful stories. That country is an amazing country, and the way Jim Barnett handled his business and the way he brought in that conglomeration of great athletes from all over the world, and he let them speak to their people, not just in English, but in the language of their own language. I came home from there in 1973. I went to Australia as a middle of the card guy, and I came back to America as a main eventer. I won my first championship the day I got back, the first match I wrestled, and I took it there and just went forward with all of it. It made my career, that 3 months I spent in Australia. It made a different wrestler out of me. I owe a lot to Australia.
Well, you can really hear the passion and fervor in the Stud's voice when he talks about how special the Australian people are. I want to remind you that Tom Dawes hails from the state. As we try to pick a winner here, these are our three question askers. Tom Dawes of Pall Mall, Tennessee, questioner number one, who had a great question about the split in Knoxville that happened in the late 70s. Dwayne Light, a personal friend of mine who really loves you. Stud, question number two. And he's a personal friend of mine. He really loves you. And then Justin Matthews from Broken Hill, South Wales, Australia, who comes from a place that you love, But again, Dwayne Light's a personal friend of mine. Who's going to be the winner this week, Stud?
Well, you know who's going to be the winner. I love your guy, too. I love Tennessee anyway. I mean, I love that state. I love Knoxville. I think his question is a great question. It's a super question. Actually, if you take three questions out of all the programs we've done, this is my show right here. These three questions are absolutely fabulous questions. And everything that happens in this segment that we do, Tony, inspires me because the people that send us stuff, it's tremendous. It's just tremendous what their knowledge of the sport and the questions that they ask. When I see them and I first start going through them, am I looking at them? I try to rate them as number one, number two, number three. I can't do it because they're all so good. And I really appreciate the people sending me these things. It takes us in different directions, Tony. It takes us away from Memphis. It takes us away from the 60s. All these are latter day questions. And it's pretty amazing. It's part of what we do here that I think makes this thing unique. It makes us unique as wrestling podcasts go around the world because we delve in everything. History, family, countries, latter day, early days. We cover just about all of it. And it's just a pleasure to be a part of this.
And who's the winner, Stud? You said all that. I mean, come on. You act like one of these football coaches in the SEC. You got to give me a winner here.
All right. We're going to go with Mr. Light. We're going to go with Mr. Light. I loved this question. They were all good today. It's really hard to pick a winner. When you got three questions like that, it's really difficult to pick a winner. But let's go with Mr. Dwayne Light. I think let's call him our winner for today.
Dwayne Light actually won something. He's never won anything off of me, Stud. I'll tell you that right now. But anyway, so Stud, on the way out, how can folks get in touch with you if they'd like to? Please plug you if you can. It's time to plug now. Plug your Facebook page and your website, my man.
Okay, we'll cover all of them. And if people got pencils, they want to write it down. You know, I really want them to come and look at my website. I think I have a pretty decent website. The Stud Store is rocking. We've got a lot of things there, and we're going to continue to add more items to that. You can find that website at tnstud.com. Very simple, tnstud.com. That's your website. Facebook is Ron Fuller Welch and Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud is a celebrity site. It allows me to hold, obviously, 30, 40,000. I don't even know how many I could put on there. And I'm getting those kind of numbers. It's staggering. Like me there, and you're going to get messages. You can communicate with me. That's wonderful. I love that communication. I try to answer as many people as I can. It's difficult at this point. Ron Fuller Welch, that's obviously the first site I had on Facebook. It's about to max out with the number of people that I can hold on there. So you can do either of those two sites, Ron Fuller Welch or Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. You can connect with me on Facebook. On Twitter and on Instagram, it's the same thing, Ron Fuller Welch. Follow me there. Those media forms are blowing up as well. We're becoming pretty darn phenomenal out there, Tony. We're becoming relevant. My name is becoming relevant again. For 30 years, I disappeared, and now I've kind of come back, and people are just ranting and raving. They say I'm a pretty good storyteller, and I love telling the stories. I'm going to keep doing it. We're going to keep rocking this thing. We're going to keep bringing people stories and information that they never knew. We talked about this before. I don't believe, and I'm not trying to boast here, I don't believe there's a more knowledgeable wrestling person on the face of the earth than me. I've been everywhere. I've grown up in it. My granddad started in 24, four generations, 20 strong, stories being told every week. Just keep joining us. Tell your friends about us. I'd like to add, too, you know, we talked a little bit about it today, about that first question today. God bless everybody that listens here. And I'm not sad to say I believe in the good Lord. And I think he puts me in this chair every week so that I can impart some information and maybe make people feel better about themselves and entertain them at least for an hour. I can't wait to let's crank it into next week.
I'll tell you this right now, Stud, I feel the love over here, and I want to remind folks, if you want to check me out during the week, I'm actually a radio guy in Knoxville, Tennessee. I've done a show here for forever, a quarter century or so. Long enough to know better, as we say. And I beg to differ with the stud. I think he's always been relevant. He drives me crazy when he says that. I know my audience absolutely loves him, loves the Studcast. I encourage folks to please spread the word. If you get an opportunity, you can check me out at TonyBasilio.com. I also do post-game shows immediately following Tennessee football games if you want some serious entertainment. And you'll hear some heat after some losses, some crazy stuff. It's mayhem. Speaking of, we also do a Sunday night offering across the Southeast and for ACC, SEC, and college football fans at large that we call Southeastern Sunday Night. And you can find me at TonyBasilio.com during the day and Tony Basilio on Twitter. And Stud, man, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be a small part of this. It's been great here, man. You know, number 13 is supposed to be unlucky for people. I feel like we turned in a lucky 13. I feel like that was a really wonderful program that we just did.
Tony, I feel like they're all pretty darn good. It's amazing. You know, when we think about it and when we talk about it, we don't even talk about it, actually, because we sit down here and within 2 minutes we talk and say hello to each other and we roll into a show. It's pretty amazing. We don't format it. It comes off the top of the head, and it rolls out there week after week, and we light them up. Hopefully, we're lighting them up just like my old granddad and just like my dad. That torch, I hope, is still lit, and maybe I'm going to be the next torchbearer for my family. You know, I'm trying to light that torch every week here and get these people, these wrestling fans worldwide, a different perspective of what the heck it's all about, and I hope that we're accomplishing that.
I'm a guy who loves classic wrestling, and I love American history as well, and I love 20th century American history, and I just love all the intertwining that we've seen so far in your family's story. And so, Stud, when we get back in episode 14, where are we going, my man?
Well, actually, we're going to become farmers. That sounds a little odd, but, you know, Dad's a little perturbed with things, and he's out of Memphis, and it's really a nasty deal for him. And we're going to end up going to the farm for a little bit. It's going to be short-lived, but that's a wonderful life. That's why I really want to hit a little bit of it, because I loved being a farmer. I love doing that. I think that people that do that for a living are luckiest people maybe on earth. Let's get into a little bit of that, but it's going to come right back to wrestling. We're never leaving wrestling because it's what it's all about.
Oh, no, and I'll give you a sneak preview of some of the questions that we may have next week. I've had a guy reach out to me and wants to ask you about that snake pit that comes up a lot. So we're going to visit the farm, and then we're going to visit the snake pit. So we're ecologically sound anyway. We're going to be outdoors. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, Tony Basilio, wishing you a Tennessee Stud day and a Tennessee Stud week. Thanks for being with us on another action-packed edition here on your Studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.